Lecture 35, Modern Legacies.
Hello, thanks for joining me again. Over the last 34 lectures, I've introduced you to over 70 great minds of the Eastern intellectual tradition. Some, like Buddha, Confucius, Al-Biruni, and Gandhi, are unique enough to have had a whole lecture to themselves. But most have been presented in pairs, because I think it's a little easier to grasp main ideas and significance in contrast. And there were a few lectures, such as those on Japanese Buddhism, on Neo-Confucianism, Tibet, and Korea, in which I quickly cited four or five thinkers, so that you could get a sense of the development of a tradition over time. In any case, you've heard a lot of names in this course. I'm going to spend the last two lectures reviewing, but also exploring some of the implications of all this. I'll be talking about the significance of these thinkers in modern-day India and China and Japan, and then I'll conclude with some suggestions about what their ideas might mean to outsiders, to Westerners like you and me. But first, let me just congratulate you on making it this far. I imagine that many of these great minds are new to most listeners. Even my colleagues, college professors, sometimes have a difficulty with this. There are very few who specialize in, say, China, who also know the thinkers from Persia and from India and Korea. And philosophy professors may not be all that familiar with the historians, the literary figures, and the scientists. We've covered a lot of ground. In part, that's because I wanted to give you a sense of the sweep and variety of the Eastern intellectual tradition, but also because there's so much there. Now, there may be some scholars who say to me, "I can't believe you didn't include the Indian monk Asanga, or the Buddhist logician Dignaga, or the Japanese Neo-Confucian and naturalist Kaibara Ikken, and what about the 18th century Chinese philosopher Dai Jun?" Okay, I know, and I'm sorry. Deciding who to leave out was one of the hardest things about putting this course together. But it's one of the great insights of life that the more you know, the better sense you have of how much you still have to learn. And I hope that at this point, you, like me, have at least a vague sense of how many marvelous ideas and fascinating thinkers are still out there in Asian cultures waiting to be discovered. I'm confident, though, that the great minds who have been included in this course will give you a basic understanding of Asian intellectual history and a solid foundation for further studies. I mentioned Asanga as one of those thinkers who was left out. But if I tell you that Asanga was a co-founder of the Buddhist Yogacara school, remember that's consciousness only, and he was also a half-brother of Vasubandhu, whom we did spend some time with way back in Lecture 14, then you already have some idea of how Asanga fits into the grand scheme of things. None of the people that I've discussed in this course are trivial or obscure, at least not to people who grew up in Asian countries. Most Indians know about Ashoka, the Buddhist king, and Aryabhata, the astronomer. Chinese people will recognize the names of Sima Qian, the historian, and Xuanzang, the Buddhist pilgrim. And the Japanese have all heard of Lady Murasaki, the novelist, Dogen, the founder of the Soto Zen school, and Zayami, the writer of No Drama. In fact, there's a Korean family who lives in my neighborhood. Okay, these aren't scholars, just regular folks. I went over to their house a couple of months ago looking for some guidance in correctly pronouncing the names of the two Chinese Neo-Confucian philosophers, Yi Huang and Yi Yi. The parents were happy to help me out, but when I asked the teenage daughters if they'd ever heard of these men, they said, "Sure, they're on our money," which is why I mentioned that fact in my lecture. It seems like I've mentioned currency several times, but that's one way that countries signal who they think is important in their traditions and cultures. Now, I don't think that the neighbor girls could have told me much about the 4-7 debate. Remember, about how the four basic virtues mentioned in Mencius are related to the seven emotions that were listed in the doctrine of the mean. But those girls had some idea of who those great minds were. And perhaps even more importantly, their family has been deeply shaped by the Confucian heritage that was dominant in Korea for centuries. I can see it in the family's emphasis on education, on their hesitancy to brag about their accomplishments, and the way that children respect their parents. Just as in America, many people have heard in a vague way of John Locke or Immanuel Kant, but even those who can't give a detailed account of the ideas of those men nevertheless often have strong opinions about private property, human rights, and the notion that a good question to test ethics is, what if everyone did it? Okay, those ideas come from somewhere. They come from those famous thinkers. Similarly, many of my students would have a hard time coming up with the details of Old Testament narratives or who wrote which books in the Bible, but they all have a pretty good idea of what it means to worship a monotheistic God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-loving, even if they themselves are not believers. The great minds of this course are studied and debated in ancient books and journals, in universities and monasteries, but their ideas have penetrated deeply into Asian society and culture, even among the less educated. So what kind of influence do these 70-plus thinkers have today? What elements of modern Asia, I'm talking about the sort of things you might encounter as a tourist or in business dealings or in popular culture, which of those aspects can be traced to the thinkers we've been discussing in the preceding 34 lectures? Frequently, these are customs, ideas, or attitudes that are puzzling to outsiders, but they make sense once you understand their roots. I'll give you a few examples in the next two lectures, arranged according to the distinct but related cultural conversations that we've been following in India and China and Japan. Remember, in the first lecture, we talked about the Darshana Hotel, the Tao Hotel, and the Do Hotel. So let's begin in India, the Darshana Hotel, where we saw a number of themes and variations. Something that came up over and over was the idea that concepts, were the concepts of samsara, remember reincarnation, karma, cosmic justice, dharma, moral duty, and moksha, liberation. These four concepts are all explored in the Upanishads, along with the ideas of Brahman, that's ultimate reality, and Atman, the individual soul. Udalaka, the first great mind in this course, taught his son, "You are that." In other words, Atman equals Brahman. And later Vedanta thinkers, such as Shankara, argued that there's nothing but Brahman. Most Indians are Hindus, about 80% of the population, and they believe in samsara and karma. And remember that even Buddha and Mahavira accepted these doctrines, but with some variations. You remember that the Buddha said that there's no such thing as a soul. It's just the five aggregates in a temporary relationship with each other. And Mahavira said everything has a soul, animate and inanimate alike. Okay, but this shared notion of reincarnation and karma is one reason that many Indians today are vegetarian. That bacon on your breakfast plate may once have been someone that you loved. And cows are held in particular reverence in India. If you travel through Indian cities today, you may see cows that are sort of wandering freely on the streets. A common greeting in India is namaste, where you press your palms together in front of your chest. And it's a Sanskrit phrase that means, "I reverently bow to you." Okay. It's been adopted by yoga practitioners in the West, often with the connotation, "I bow to the divine within you," which fits with Shankara's teachings that Brahman is in everyone and everything. Okay, that may be taking things a bit too far. I'm not sure that Indians would actually think of that every time they make this very common greeting. But the verb nama is used all the time in chants to praise gods and goddesses, so that potential is certainly there. A second theme in Indian culture is an acknowledgement of the value of different spiritual paths and different stages in life. India is a very religious place. If you travel there, you'll see temples everywhere, as well as images of numerous divinities. Shankara preferred the way of wisdom as a path to liberation. That's where you realize that Brahman and Atman are ultimately one. But it was Ramanuja who laid the philosophical groundwork for theism with his ideas of qualified non-dualism. He said that the different gods may ultimately be manifestations of the one reality that's Brahman. But according to Ramanuja, bhakti, or the way of devotion in which one worships and praises a personal god, that's the highest path. In India today, it's not the deities of the Vedas that get the most attention, but gods from the epics, like the Mahabharata, and from the Puranas, which are later tales of gods and heroes. The most important of these divinities are Shiva, who destroys and creates, and Vishnu, the preserver, and Devi, the goddess, who can take many forms, including the powerful Durga, the beneficent Lakshmi, and the frightening Kali. And just as Hinduism includes many spiritual paths, India also incorporates multiple religions, from Muslims, about 13% of the population. Okay, we're still talking about 150 million people or so, almost as many Muslims as in Pakistan. There are also Christians in India, about 24 million, and Sikhs, 21 million. Remember that they follow the first guru, Nanak, and you can sometimes recognize Sikh men by the fact that they wear turbans. There are Buddhists, about 8 million of them. The Buddhists in India are mostly recent converts from the untouchable class, or from Dalits. There are also Jains, about 4 million. Remember, they follow Mahavira and its doctrine of ahimsa, of nonviolence. And there are also tens of thousands of Jews and Parsis in India. Remember, the Parsis are followers of Zarathustra. They believed in that dualism of worshiping Ahura Mazda, who was opposed to the Angra Mainyu, the god of bad things. A third theme is an emphasis on dharma, particularly in the context of caste and family obligations. Now, you remember the Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna, who is an avatar of Vishnu, taught Arjuna the way of action, karma yoga, by which Arjuna could fulfill his caste duty as a warrior, but not get bad karma by not worrying about the consequences of the actions that he was required by his caste to undertake. Okay. Most Indians today, if they think of philosophy, will immediately think of the Bhagavad Gita. The importance of caste varies from region to region, and it's probably less rigid overall than it once was, but it's still a factor in contemporary India. One subcaste, called a jati, is an integral part of a person's social connections and obligations and identity. Indians can usually guess someone's caste by their last name, and considerations of caste limit potential marriage partners. Most marriages in India are still arranged, though with the consent of the bride and groom, and matrimonial ads in the newspapers will often specify caste. Untouchability is officially forbidden by the Indian Constitution, but discrimination still exists, as do affirmative action programs in government and education for so-called scheduled castes. Dharma within the family, that is, fulfilling one's duty as a husband or a wife, and especially in children, obeying and respecting their parents, is a key social value. It frequently appears in Bollywood movies, or that's Hindi cinema, where the resolving of tensions between an estranged son and his parents is often the emotional climax in what might otherwise be simply a romantic musical comedy. And there are often grandparents in these pictures as well, in contrast to American romance movies that tend to just focus on the two individuals and their best friends. A fourth theme from Indian intellectual history is the importance of direct insight, often through meditation or yoga, in addition to logical analysis. We've seen several examples in this course of Indian scholarship and logic, such as Nagarjuna's fourfold negation. Remember, we called it a tetralemma. There are four possibilities when you analyze whether something has a particular attribute. For example, with existence, something either exists or it does not exist, or it both exists and does not exist at the same time, depending on the perspective, or it neither exists nor does not exist. Okay, and you can do that for any attribute, whether something is true or fair or good. You can run through those same possibilities. Okay, that's that logical analysis. Logic is part of education oftentimes, and education in modern India has not been as widely available as in, say, China, but it's still highly valued. And many Indian parents are eager for their children to become doctors or engineers. There's even a goddess, Sarasvati, to whom students can pray to help them pass their exams. Thinkers of all kinds, philosophers, scientists, writers, and poets are held in high esteem. In fact, our English word pundit was borrowed from the Sanskrit pandita, meaning a scholar or a learned person. Yet in addition to ordinary knowledge, direct insight into reality, like that offered by yogic practices of Patanjali in his Yoga Sutra, that has also been widely sought. Remember that yoga was originally a way to calm one's mind and disentangle purusha, or pure consciousness, from prakriti, or primordial matter. This was the dualism of the Hindu Samkhya school, as articulated by Ishvara Krishna. Yogic practices can still be found throughout India today, and even though Buddhism is no longer prominent in the land of its birth, the ideas of Indian Buddhist philosophers, many of whom closely analyze mental processes and meditation. Those ideas are influential across East Asia and Southeast Asia. India is still a land of holy men. There are ascetics who have renounced ordinary pleasures to live lives of poverty and celibacy, self-denial, and spiritual attainment. In doing so, they may follow the Jain path of Mahavira as a monk, or they may be devotees of Vishnu or Shiva in the monastic order founded by Shankara, or they may be completing the fourth stage of the Hindu stages of life, the ashramas. Remember, you begin as a student and then a householder and then go into retirement as a hermit, still with your spouse, with a reduced property. And then the final stage is to be an ascetic, to give up all property and all relationships, familial relationships. Muslim Sufis were also revered as holy men, though Ahmad Sirhindi, at the time of Akbar the Great, worked to make sure that Sufis stayed within the bounds of Sharia law and didn't stray into Hindu notions of monism. Even Gandhi's popular appeal came in part from his adopting the lifestyle of an Indian ascetic. Okay, we're at theme number 5 in India, and that's a preference for oral rather than written culture. The Vedas, like the Buddhist scriptures, were memorized and passed down for centuries by Brahmin priests before they were ever committed to writing. It was felt that the sounds of words had power, like mantras in both Hinduism and Buddhism, and reading was a poor substitute for hearing the truth. It was important to have a teacher, a guru, who could explain the meaning of sutras. And sutras, remember, refer to both Buddhist scriptures, but also Hindu philosophical texts. And it's a genre of writing, these sutras, which is sometimes little more than lists. And they're great for memorizing. They're kind of hard to understand on their own. That's why you need a teacher to explain them. Groundbreaking scholarship in India has often taken the form of commentaries on classic texts, as we saw with Nagarjuna, who wrote about the emptiness of the perfection of wisdom sutras, or the Tibetan Tsongkhapa, who wrote commentaries on Nagarjuna, or the Vedanta philosophers Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva, who each wrote commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. I think Gandhi also wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. There was a great love in India for the auditory arts of epic and drama, poetry and music. Some have even suggested that the way the Indians use their car horns constantly, and if you ever are on a highway in India, this will be obvious to you immediately. Some have suggested that the sort of communication by honking is connected to a tradition of making your meaning known through your ears. A sixth and final theme from Indian intellectual tradition is a conjunction of religion and politics. From the time of the Vedas, the obligations of ruling, warring, and religious duty were united in the Kshatriya caste. That's the warrior ruler caste that Arjuna belonged to. It's not a coincidence that both Mahavira and Buddha came from this social strata. There are also the three aims of life. Remember the three P's: prosperity, artha, and pleasure, kama, and piety, dharma. And those were all viewed as legitimate aims within Hinduism. So Kautilya's political manual, the Arthashastra, all about prosperity or politics, was read alongside the Kama Sutra, about pleasure, and Dharma Sutras. We haven't talked a lot about Dharma Sutras, but these are texts like the Laws of Manu that talk about the obligations of Dharma. Those were all sort of seen as complementary ways of understanding what life was about. Kautilya offered a rational, detailed analysis of statecraft, and King Ashoka provided a model for a religiously devout yet tolerant monarch. Even though there aren't many Buddhists in India anymore, you can see visual allusions to Ashoka all over the place, in the money, in the national emblem, in the flag, and so forth. Today, India is the world's largest democracy, and though Hinduism is the majority religion, India nevertheless has an official policy of religious freedom and tolerance. This is in many ways the achievement of Mahatma Gandhi and Rabindranath Tagore, who is almost as well known in India as Gandhi, and probably even more beloved by Bengali-speaking Indians and Bangladeshis who can read Tagore's poetry and sing his songs in the original language. This marvelous heritage of religious pluralism is currently being challenged by communal politics, which pits Hindus against Muslims, against Sikhs. there are some who want to make Hinduism, or rather a particular kind of Hinduism, synonymous with Indian identity. Historical tensions between India and Pakistan remain high, and although Muhammad Iqbal's moderate, open-minded, reforming version of Islam is still acknowledged in Pakistan, that nation, which Iqbal was the first to propose, has since turned to something more akin to a repressive theocracy. But this can serve as a reminder that the ideas of our great thinkers are still very much in play today as they're challenged and adapted and revised in light of changing social and political circumstances. And nowhere is this more true than in China, which saw an explicit rejection of traditional culture under Mao, but which nevertheless managed to retain some of the characteristic elements from its long history, as we saw in the previous lecture. Key themes that come from the great minds of China include, first, a constant appeal to history. The Chinese sometimes speak with pride of their 5,000 years of history. That's probably a little too long, since Chinese civilization, as expressed in their unique writing system, goes back to about 1500 BC. But still, we're talking about 3,500 years of continuous cultural development. And during most of that period, China led the world in government administration, in the refined arts, and manufacturing, and technology. Remember paper that was invented by Cailun in the 2nd century AD, not to mention printing, the magnetic compass, and gunpowder. Other cultures around the world had their moments. You know, Greek culture was wonderful, as was the Roman Empire. But in China, it was one great dynasty after another. The Han Dynasty, and then the Tang Dynasty, the Song Dynasty, Ming Dynasty, Qing Dynasty, plus those 100 schools of philosophy that were in the Warring States period before the dynastic system even got started, or at least before China was unified under the Qing Dynasty and the first emperor. Furthermore, historians in China, starting with Sima Qian, were keeping careful records of all of this. So the Chinese have a rich storehouse of historical precedents and narratives to draw upon in nearly any discussion, and the ancient practice of ancestor worship has also probably inclined them to respectfully look back to the past for answers to life's great questions. Even Confucius, who stands at the beginning of the Chinese intellectual tradition, claimed to be a transmitter rather than an innovator, and he drew upon the sage kings of the early Zhou dynasty as his model. Great thinkers in times of crisis, so from Han Yu in the 9th century after the terrible Anlushan rebellion, to Zhu Xi in the 12th century when Mongols were starting to invade, to Kang Youwei in the 20th century with the incursion of the West, all of them turned back to Confucius for guidance and inspiration, even as they were radically reinterpreting his teachings. Second theme from Chinese thought is an emphasis on practical, this-worldly philosophies that highlight harmony, balance, and social order. China is a much less religious place than India. Okay. Sure, Buddhism has had considerable success, as has religious Taoism, and there have been a number of popular folk religions, but the dominant ideology in China is Confucianism, thanks in part to the rise of the scholar gentry class and over 1,000 years of civil service exams based on the Confucian classics. Confucianism is like a religion. There are key texts, there are ethical requirements and ceremonies on behalf of ancestors, and a path for personal cultivation. But Confucianism doesn't have much to say about God, or the gods, or afterlife. What it does stress is education, government, ritual, hierarchy, and social interactions. Confucius's influence in these areas is everywhere, from showing respect to your teachers, to elaborate funeral ceremonies, to gift-giving rituals, to family relations, where there are different words in Chinese for older brother and younger brother. Remember that that's one of the five Confucian relationships. One might even argue that the Chinese obsession with business cards has Confucian roots, so that when you meet somebody for the first time, you'll know exactly where you rank in relation to that other person. And there's a ritual of exchange as well. You always want to give or receive a business card, or any gift for that matter, with two hands to show that you have an undivided heart. The third theme in China is a keen appreciation of nature and its cycles. The Taoist way of nature and spontaneous, effortless action or non-action way as articulated by Lao Tzu and Zhuangzi, found expression in poetry and arts, like the mountain and water monochrome ink paintings. Chinese, it's Shanshui, mountain and water paintings that you see on Chinese scrolls, and that are still regarded as cultural treasures. Chinese are often enthusiastic about excursions to see scenic sites, and the ideals of retirement, tranquility, and simplicity continue to resonate with many Chinese, even those living in the midst of hectic cities. And that's a lot of Chinese people these days. There are Taoist priests and temples in China, not nearly as many as Buddhist temples, but Taoism may be more important as a sensibility or an attitude rather than as a distinct religion. There are also contemporary practices with roots in Taoism. The concepts of yin and yang, remember those complementary opposites in a cyclical ebb and flow that underlie natural phenomena. Yin and yang are essential to Chinese medicine and even to Chinese cooking. Dongzhongshu in the 2nd century BC combined Confucian philosophy with the concepts of yin and yang and then also the five phases. Remember, wood, fire, earth, metal, and water. Neo-Confucians in the 11th century further developed those Confucian theories of nature, partly in a response to Taoist and Buddhist ideas. And those notions of Li and Qi are still an integral part of Chinese culture. Remember Zhou Duoni and his diagram of the great ultimate. It was a Taoist alchemical chart that he reinterpreted in Confucian ways. That diagram is called in Chinese the Taiji Tu. And that first word is the same expression that appears in Taiji Quan, supreme ultimate boxing. It's that slow motion calisthenics. I won't try to do it for you here, but that you'll see older people doing early in the morning in parks all over China. And the Cheng brothers and Zhu Xi, as I said, had those principles of Li, the ideas of Li, that's principle, combined with Qi, material force. Okay. The concepts of the five phases and Qi are crucial in acupuncture, which regulates the flow of qi in the body, and in feng shui, which tries to channel the flow of qi in the earth or in a building. So you might call on a feng shui expert if you want to build a high rise to make sure that it won't disrupt the natural forces of qi in the surrounding landscape. And qi is an important idea in martial arts as well. When we return for our last lecture, I'll continue with a few more themes from the great minds of China, along with some contemporary implications, and we'll talk about Japan as well. But I wanted to conclude here with some personal examples. I lived in Taiwan for 2 years and had a chance to see modern Confucian culture every day. One of the things that initially puzzled me was Chinese politeness. When you visit someone's home, they have to offer you something to eat or drink, and you have to turn it down, even if you're dying of thirst. And then they'll offer it to you again, and you'll say, "No, no, I'm fine, don't worry." And then on the third time, you can politely accept what's offered, say a glass of water. They want to be hospitable and not pushy, and you want to be appreciative but not greedy. There's a ritual to how this goes back and forth between host and guest, which is a Confucian relationship, not one of the big five, but an important idea. Harder to understand were the times when we made appointments to see people and then they were deliberately not at home when we came back at the specified day and hour. They hadn't really wanted to continue the conversation, but it would have been rude to say so directly. That would have made us lose face. And that's a really important concept that has to do with a person's dignity and social status and public persona. Sometimes when we'd knock on a door and people would open it and see us and then say, "Oh, please, won't you come in?" Even as they were shutting the door, they have to say come in even if they don't really want you to. It's not just what's said, but it's how it's said. China is a land of polite, face-saving excuses. And eventually, I learned to do this as well. I mean, once I forgot to go to an appointment, and when I asked my more culturally savvy associate what we should do, he said, "We're going to tell him we got sick." "That's not true," I said. He explained, "If we tell them that we got sick, they'll figure that we forgot. If we tell them that we forgot, they'll suspect that we didn't want to talk to them at all." "Ah," I said. Okay, Chinese people know the difference between telling the truth and lying, but in these types of social interactions, there are ways to clearly communicate intentions. Everyone understands how to read these words and actions. It just took me a while to pick up on the subtle hints that were behind the polite talk. So 3 quick lessons that I learned. The first, is when you encounter Asian customs that seem strange, there are usually reasons for them. They make sense within their own cultural context. Second lesson, quite often, there's some great mind behind the attitude or practice. Only later did I realize that what I was seeing could be traced back to Confucius and his ideas of ritual and deference and hierarchy. In fact, in the Analects, there's a story of how Confucius himself once received a gift of a piglet from a disreputable official who wanted to employ him. The gift obligated Confucius to make a visit, so he waited until he knew that that official was not at home before going to offer his thanks. Unfortunately, Confucius ran into this guy on the road, awkward, and had to give a polite, non-committal answer in person. Okay, the third lesson is sometimes we can gain an appreciation for foreign ways. After 2 years in Taiwan, I experienced a sort of reverse cultural shock when I returned to the U.S. Americans were so rude and demanding and overbearing in comparison. It seemed like China was a much more humane and civilized culture, which of course is exactly what the Chinese had thought for centuries. When you come back for the last lecture, I'll talk about a few more cultural themes from China and Japan, and then some ways in which the East and West might learn from each other. I'll see you then.